Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
I'm doing just fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. We posted an episode to our Patreon. It's a more current case. We have more of those coming your way, so go out there and check it out if you're interested.
And especially if you were enraged by the Brock Turner case, you might want to hear our recent Patreon episode.
Absolutely.
You can find our Patreon page at patreon.com/Generation Y.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling T-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
Tonight's case, it's talked about as a missing persons slash murder slash wrongful conviction. And as usual, it's one of those cases we like to cover because it has a hook. And it's not very straightforward. One of the characters in this story is a big Dexter fan. And I
actually love that show. So I thought that was an interesting connection, but it's not exactly what the story's about. It's more about a teen girl whose life is ended abruptly. So what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight we're talking about the murder of Mackenzie Cowell, who lived in Wenatchee, Washington. It's one thing that I noticed when we were researching this is Wenatchee is known for its apples, and it's known as the apple capital of the world because there are so many apple orchards.
I think I had a granola hippie friend that moved away from Missouri to Washington to work on an apple orchard. That's pretty cool. So what happens to Mackenzie on the day she disappears?
The date in question here is February 9th, 2010, in Wenatchee, Washington. Mackenzie Cowell, let's talk about her for a minute here. Her parents were divorced, but her dad and stepmother were very supportive of her. Her mom was very close to her. She was 17 years old, but people knew that she was already setting and achieving goals. So they looked at her as someone who was going to succeed in life.
She had a love for dancing and music, and this was one of her hobbies. She was in a dance troupe. She would get to compete and perform in front of audiences.
She was attending a beauty school. She loved doing hair, makeup. No one ever had anything bad to say about her, just well-liked. The beauty school she was attending was the Academy of Hair Design. It's on February 9th, 2010, when she leaves the school saying that she would be back in 15 minutes.
She leaves around 3 o'clock and school lets out at around 5. So she's leaving early, but she's coming back in 15 minutes. She asks, "Do I have to sign out if I'm just going to be gone for 15 minutes?" And they let her go without signing out. And we have her on security footage walking out the door, out to her car at that time.
But Mackenzie never returns.
She leaves in her car, we presume, and she isn't seen after that for the rest of the day. Because she doesn't return home, her father is calling her, seeing where she's at, leaves her a message. She doesn't call back. He leaves her another message saying, "Hey, you need to call me." And he goes through the emotions of, why is she not returning home? Why is she not returning my calls? He's getting angry, but then he starts getting worried because he hasn't heard from her.
It's about 2 hours later that there's a call reporting that police had found Mackenzie's car. Her car was 5 miles away from the school.
But it was found up in sort of a off-road region where it shouldn't have been. So this rancher who called in the car tells the officers, "Yeah, it was just left here." And the officers run the tags. They find the owner. Law enforcement will call Mackenzie's father, Reed Cowell, and say that they have located his car because it's registered under his name. And he will ask them, "Did you locate my daughter? Because she's missing also." He will drive out to where they found the car, and it's nowhere he thinks that his daughter should have been. And they will take the car in as evidence.
It's 4 days later, on February 13th, 2010, when there is a discovery of a body. It's 30 miles away in Crescent Bar. An autopsy revealed that Mackenzie Cowell was struck in the head, strangled, and stabbed.
She'd been stabbed multiple times. The knife was actually sticking out of her shoulder. It's almost as if the attacker was trying to hack her limbs off or dismember her, but gave up halfway through.
Or was interrupted.
Yeah. She also has duct tape around her mouth.
She had been wearing her uniform that she had worn to the Academy of Hair Design, and the medical examiner said that she likely died the same day she disappeared. The investigators move quickly. They're trying to figure out what had happened to Mackenzie. They also want to find out who did this to her. This is an obvious homicide. They end up with several suspects.
Yeah, this is really odd because you would think that they would go after people that know her, or not go after them, but question them. Obviously, they're questioning her father, but he was at home and looking for his daughter.
Mackenzie's mom had a boyfriend by the name of Joey Fisher. And Joey Fisher and Mackenzie never really got along, from what we understand. What got the investigators interested in him was they found out that they had a big fight the night before Mackenzie went missing.
And being that Mackenzie was so even keel, you know, good spirited, for her to get into an argument with somebody, sort of a big deal.
Of course, you know, there are many people who don't get along with their step parent. So from that angle, it doesn't seem really that fishy to me. But again, they need to go to people that are close to Mackenzie who might have a reason to kill her.
He's the stepfather. They don't get along. He has a drinking problem. It's said that he has all these issues, whether or not he is actually an alcoholic and, you know, has these problems is one thing, but these are all elements that the police are looking into. But it seems that he has a sufficient alibi for the day of the disappearance.
The next suspect on the list is a young man by the name of Christopher Scott Wilson.
Now, Wilson was seen on the security footage leaving the beauty school just minutes after Mackenzie, which seems to coincide with her disappearance. They also get some anonymous tips from people pointing the finger at Wilson.
In August of 2010, a friend wrote a letter to police claiming that Wilson had an obsession with death, dead bodies, and serial killers.
He was super into Dexter and even had a tattoo of Hannibal Lecter, which, ooh, how edgy.
Yeah, it was on his arm, and it was the Hannibal Lecter wearing the mask.
His friend feels compelled enough to call the police and say, you need to look into this guy.
And also related a story about how he choked a female friend from behind while they were walking, and then abruptly stopped and wouldn't talk about it. You know, it bothered her quite a bit, as you would imagine. This wasn't like a joke. At least he didn't make it seem like a joke. Christopher Scott Wilson was 30 years old and was attending the same beauty school that Mackenzie Cowell was because he wanted to run his mom's business in the future. She had a beauty salon. He stuck out because his hair was dyed black. He wore eyeliner. And
he was one of the only guys in the class, obviously.
Yeah, he was just one of three men in the class. They said he was attacked for being homosexual, even though he wasn't. It was just, you know, a lot of people would look at him and see the eyeliner, see his dyed hair. I'm sure some people in the audience have gone through that before, where people assume that you're one way just because of your style, your look.
So he's the oddball in the class, and he's older, which I'm sure makes him gives him a little bit of a creep factor.
He also worked at a funeral home at one point, was later fired because the owner of the funeral home became uncomfortable with him because of some of the things that he was doing. Now, he didn't elaborate as far as I could tell, and he said it wasn't too bad, but it still didn't sit right with him. But he was fired. He was let go.
Now, officers ask Wilson if he was friends with Mackenzie, if they were dating, if they had any sort of association. And he says no. And he goes on to say that they didn't even talk. Yet some other classmates say that they did talk and that Wilson might have had a liking for Mackenzie, which she's a very attractive young female. He's an older male, so maybe he thought that he could make a move on her.
Yeah, the students that were interviewed, one said that they noticed a developing relationship between the two, and another said she saw Cowell and Wilson interact several times, had heard that Wilson said he was developing feelings for Cowell, and had heard that Chris said she was hot.
But as far as any relationship or even friendship, it's kind of unsubstantiated.
Yeah, really all they had were the interviews that they did with other students who had things to say about the two of them. But outside of that, they really couldn't establish anything. But they started to hear some crazy things about Christopher Scott Wilson. One person said Chris liked to cut people up, something he apparently did while working at funeral homes, which is the rumor I heard. But again, it's nothing that I've been able to substantiate. And so we don't know if this is just someone judging someone because they look dark, or whether the word got out about what he might have been doing at the funeral home that got him fired.
So the police have the mom's boyfriend as one suspect. Now they have Chris Wilson as another, as they're working out the details and the evidence. Then we have a third element to this case, and it's a woman named Liz Reed. She was going to college, actually pretty productive woman, but she also was selling and using drugs, had been an informant for the police, and she comes in saying that she knows what happened to this girl, who killed her, and how it was done. She goes on to say that she's even seen a snuff film of this girl's murder. So we have what appears to be a direct witness who knows a lot about Mackenzie's disappearance and death.
Liz Reed named two men, Sam Cuevas and Emmanuel Cerros. They were criminals, convicted criminals, drug dealers, and people that Liz Reed said she hung out with. It's not like she came in and said, here are the two guys. Yeah, I saw a video. And then the police ran with it. No, she seemed to give a lot of details.
She gave the location of where the body was taken to, even the motive for these two men. She said that they thought Mackenzie was a narc or an informant, like Liz was. And they had to shut her up, but it was a case of mistaken identity, and that it was somebody else that was the snitch or the narc. So they targeted Mackenzie and did this to her because they thought that she was a snitch. Just sort of a loose.
She also gave the detail that they had to choke Mackenzie Cowell twice, because after they choked her the first time and thought she was dead, it turned out that she was still alive.
Which, that's a very believable detail, because most people don't understand that when you choke somebody, it's not like in Dexter where you just squeeze their neck for a minute and then they die and it's all over. No, it takes time, effort, and half the time they will go unconscious and then come to. So this detail makes sense because it is in line with how she died, and it's something that happens a lot in real life.
Well, the police take what she has to say very seriously, and they spend quite a number of months looking into this whole story, trying to find this so-called snuff film. I mean, if they could find that, then they would be able to positively identify the killers and what happened to Mackenzie Cowell. But they're not successful. They end up bringing Liz Reed back in to talk to her, and then she changes her story.
She says that she made it all up and she recants. But that's not so easily dismissed, because it appears she had some of the details of the disappearance and murder correct. So how can she just throw it all out? This really confuses the investigators and delays the investigation and prolongs the case.
Well, according to Liz Reed, she said she changed her story because she was feeling threatened by police and was worried they were going to charge her with murder. But of course, the detectives are confused because they didn't consider her a suspect. I mean, she was an informant, and then she was giving them details on this case, and they just wanted to be able to use her information, but it wasn't working out.
She's the one that came forward to them. They weren't honing in on her. So why was she feeling threatened? Or is she saying that she felt threatened and now she's recanting? It doesn't make any sense. Her story is just chaos.
To further confuse things, Liz Reed later comes up with a ring that she said belonged to Mackenzie Cowell. If you check out pictures of Mackenzie, well, there is a picture that shows her wearing a ring that looks identical to the one that Liz Reed produces.
We have a photo with her wearing this ring, and they've recovered her body. The ring is not on her, but do we know if she was wearing that ring that day? We don't. And Liz has a ring that is very similar. It's one of those things where I don't know if that ring actually belonged to Mackenzie or not, but the police cannot prove it did. So again, they're pretty much disregarding Liz's story.
Yeah, it just brings up a bunch of questions. So if she only found out about this murder later and was shown a snuff film, how would she have come into possession of this ring? I mean, did the so-called drug dealers who she said murdered Mackenzie give her the ring and say, hey, here's proof? I mean, why would they do that?
She's placing herself at the crime now.
Really, in the end, because Liz Reed is unreliable, they can't really use anything she's telling them because she seems like she's making the whole thing up.
And when they question these men, their responses to the questioning and whatnot are more perplexed than fear or anything else.
Yeah, like, how did we get dragged into this?
Yeah. Yes, these guys are criminals. Yes, they are drug dealers, but there's not a lot of snitching and whatnot going on. For them to murder a young white girl would bring hellfire down upon them. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for them to bring more attention to themselves over something like this, as opposed to just, hey, somebody called the police on a drug deal. Who knows what drug deal? Who knows if it actually got them arrested? But to murder somebody over that, especially in this smaller town, doesn't make a lot of sense.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Now, we always talk about the boyfriend, and we haven't mentioned him yet. Joaquin Villasano. They're going to question him. give him a lie detector test. And of course, when they ask him, do you know what happened? Did you have anything to do with this? His answers are coming up as showing deception. And he is such a prominent suspect at this point that police and media are dropping his name. This doesn't look good for him.
And the other thing that happened was when Mackenzie left the school to go away for 15 minutes, guess who she texted? She texted Joaquin. So it's all very suspicious. But in the end, his alibi frees him of suspicion, much like what happened with Joey Fisher, Mackenzie's mom's boyfriend. So their alibis are checking out, and they just don't feel like they have anything there. But they do have one person to go back to, and that's Christopher Scott Wilson, who, I mean, I know when we talked about this, Justin, if you just think about the way this guy looks with the eyeliner and the black hair, you get the whole West Memphis 3 vibe again, where it's, oh, that's the different guy. He's probably a Satanist, and he probably wants to murder people.
Yeah, and Wilson and his supporters will say that this is the exact reason he was targeted by police. Yet they asked him if he would come in and answer some questions, and he conceded. They had found two profiles of DNA on the duct tape that they retrieved from Mackenzie. And they ask Chris Wilson, hey, can we get a DNA profile from you? And again, he agrees.
So early cooperation, which is good.
But when they find that his DNA matches one of the profiles on that duct tape, they come down hard on him.
Well, they say it matches, and he shuts up. He wants a lawyer.
Which, that's what you do.
Right. I mean, you're not qualified. At this point, whether he did it or not, especially if he didn't do it, he needs the lawyer up. The testing, though, that they did on the duct tape was YSTR testing. This is usually done for paternity reasons, and it's also used when the sample is very low and it's a mixed profile, meaning there's more than one DNA contributor to it. So they had to use YSTR, from what we understand. It means that the accuracy of this is 1 in 2,700. Which isn't like what you hear on other tests when they do DNA testing and they say, oh, it's 1 in 1 million or 1 in 240 quadrillion or whatever it is. This is 1 in 2,700. This is literally saying it's like a paternal test. So it's not quite as impressive.
They also have a cigarette butt found at the scene that has a DNA profile on it, but it's a female profile found on that cigarette. It's enough, though, that it points them at Wilson. I think that's a pretty good piece of evidence myself. I don't care what kind of DNA test it was, because if it's a match, even if it wasn't Chris, then we have to assume that it was one of his family members or his parents. That just doesn't seem right, so... The evidence is pointing to Chris, and it had little to nothing to do with his obsession with Hannibal Lecter or anything dark and edgy.
They focus on Christopher at this point. One of the first things they do is they go over to his mother's business, and they go through the entire business, and they find some blood in different places in the salon. His mother runs a salon. They take samples. They will DNA test those samples. They find DNA that belongs to Chris, but they also find unknown male DNA samples from blood in that business. But there is no DNA found that belongs to Mackenzie Cowell. But at this time, there's also a question of where he lived.
They find out that he was living at an apartment at the time of the murder, but he had since moved to a new address. So they have to go to both addresses to collect evidence. But it's at this old apartment that they find a video recording that him and a female friend of his had made at the old apartment. At first, it appears that he just wants to get his security deposit back. So he's videotaping and recording the cleanliness of the apartment. But his female friend focuses on a certain place on the carpet where there's a stain. And when the police get there, they check out this area and there's not a visible stain, but they go ahead and do some testing anyways. And they find that there was blood.
Yeah, they pull up that carpet and it's obvious that there was blood that spilled into that area. They also go through the computers and they find that Christopher Scott Wilson had taken pictures of his friend lying in that spot. And it's just really fishy. It's like, why is she lying in that exact spot? Now, of course, they're doing many interviews and they find out from his friend, and her name is Tessa. She said that, oh, I had passed out drunk and just happened to be in that spot. I don't know. And then when they interviewed other people, they found out that she had said, I don't know why, but Chris had asked me to pose in that spot. And that's later where they found the blood. So it's very, very suspicious.
They do DNA testing. They're not doing the YSTR. They're doing the more specific tests. And it comes back as Mackenzie.
Yeah, Mackenzie Cowell's blood. Now, going back to that video recording, Tessa is heard on the recording, you know, talking about the stain because Chris is saying, hey, you know, this is looking really clean. And she's basically replying, yeah, considering what happening. So a little adjustment while she's talking. But if you watch that, it seems very, very suspicious and almost like they know that's blood. That's just how it feels anyway.
If you just look at the video and you don't know that that's a stain and you don't know that the blood is going to be tied back to Mackenzie, it could be a very innocent, honest video of them checking out the apartment to make sure that he gets his security deposit back. But once you understand that this blood stain now comes back as Mackenzie, it changes everything. The fact that this video was taken at the time he was moving out, before investigators were even coming at him, or before investigators ever went to the apartment, that's telling too.
Yeah, I really think that the video's purpose was to get his security deposit back or to ensure, hey, this was the condition when I left it. You know, that video was made about 4 days before the police got into that apartment. So it's really, really strange. And because you can see the stain in the video, and then when the police got there, they couldn't see it. That to them meant it had been cleaned again. But we can't prove who cleaned it. It just, someone had gone in and cleaned it even more to where you couldn't see it with the naked eye. Of course, since Tessa's on this video and she was posing in the very spot where that blood was found, well, the police are now interested in Tessa as well. Apparently, she had dated Chris in the past. At that time, she actually had a different boyfriend. Apparently not romantically linked to Chris anymore, but they were still good friends. So the police, they look at these pictures and they see her posing as a dead person. That's how they take it. And they say, well, we think Tessa might be involved in this. They think she may have helped Chris in some way, possibly after the murder. So she was charged. She was accused of impeding the police probe. Now, she does bail out and they don't actually seek charges after that. She bails out and then it's sort of like they let her go.
They don't have much against her. They can't place her at a murder scene. They can't place her at the disposal of the body with the disposal of the body. There's nothing tying her to her car, to the body, nothing. So prosecution's thinking, okay, we have some incriminating video evidence of you lying in the very spot where this murder probably happened, but that's it.
So at that point, she's off the hook if she had been involved. I will say that I personally found it very suspicious that on the day that Mackenzie was likely murdered, that Tessa called her boyfriend. This was about somewhere between 9 and 10:30 at night, talking about several calls. She seemed upset. And according to her boyfriend, she said, "Something really bad happened. Please pray for me." The boyfriend told the detectives that didn't make much sense because she was not religious. She was anti-religion. And then he said she later called back and said, "Everything's fine." A former boyfriend of Tessa's also told the police that Tessa visited him either on like the 9th or 10th, and that he said she was acting really weird. She said that she had come by to get some of her belongings, but she never did. She just seemed really off. So that's not proof of anything, but you wonder what she did know. If she's acting weird because she had witnessed Mackenzie Cowell's death or had seen her body or was told about it, this might support that, but it's not proof. It's just really speculation based on things that were said by a former boyfriend and her boyfriend at the time.
At this point, they're going after Wilson, but they haven't got a confession from him because he lawyered up. So what they have going for them is he left the beauty school shortly after Mackenzie. His DNA profile was found on the duct tape that was found on Mackenzie. And when they searched his old apartment, they found a blood stain that the DNA profile definitely matches Mackenzie. This is the main staples of their case against him, I think.
Yeah, there was some other information, like he borrowed a friend's car. He borrowed the car between 4 p.m. and 5:15 p.m. This was on February 9th, the same day that Mackenzie went missing. Wilson wanted to keep the car longer, but his friend did not let him. She wanted the car back.
It's a little suspicious that he needs to borrow a car on this same day, and he needs to extend his loan on it. What does he need this car for? Why wasn't he in class at that time? He just happens to leave just after Mackenzie, early from class.
Mackenzie was likely killed between 3:33 and 3:45 p.m. of that day, according to, you know, the information that the police obtained from the medical examiner. So sometime that afternoon, which would have been about 30 to 45 minutes after she left the school. The most they could come up with was when she drove away, it was said that she drove in the direction of Christopher Scott Wilson's apartment. But, you know, I mean, if you can turn left or right or whatever it is, of course, you know, what are the odds you'll turn towards someone's apartment? It's not real definitive.
It's 50%, really.
When they talked to other people that had been in the area, there were several people that had witnessed a person walking away from where her car was found. And that person matched the description of Christopher Scott Wilson. So again, this is not definitive evidence. It's all circumstantial, aside from the duct tape and the blood found in the apartment. You know, he has many supporters. He was quite popular. The people that knew him, that spent time with him, if you listen to them talk, they make a good case in terms of his personality, how much they trust him, how much they believe that he would not hurt a fly. I'm sure you've heard some of their comments, Justin, but they're so certain that he is not a violent person.
Yeah, he's not capable. And his mom is one of his biggest advocates.
What do you think about all this? You have the evidence that's against him, but then you have all these people saying, hey, they've got the wrong guy. He wouldn't do this.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting because at the preliminary stage of the trial, prosecutor actually offers him a plea. He says, plead guilty to first-degree manslaughter, under 7 years in prison. This includes an unrelated charge of assault allegedly carried out against another woman a few months prior to Mackenzie's death. So we have less than 7 years for a manslaughter charge against Mackenzie. And the manslaughter charge is really about 6 years. So 6 years for abducting a woman, brutally killing her, and dumping her body. I think that the prosecutor doesn't believe that he has a very strong case against Wilson. And I'm not sure why, because of a lot of the physical evidence we have here, but the DNA testing on the duct tape, not exactly the top-notch test that they could do. And also, they can't place Wilson and McKenzie at the apartment together. They can't place them together pretty much at all after she leaves the school. So this is a offer that they give Wilson, and he turns it down flatly, saying, I'm innocent. I'm not going to take any time.
Well, you mentioned how like they may not have felt strong about their case against Christopher Scott Wilson, but another thing that I think was interesting was they checked the cell phone records of McKenzie, and it showed that her phone was being used that day. Now, when you talk about cell towers and stuff, it was actually being used where it could have been the Burkill Apartments where Christopher Scott Wilson lived, or it could have been used over at the Orondo Street boat launch near where her body was found. That's also not looking too good for Christopher Scott Wilson. But again, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. And some have even said, well, yeah, they found her blood in his apartment, but you can't prove that he's the one that made her bleed there. Now, I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I mean, I guess I get it.
Well, and the defense says that her throat was slit, her jugular was cut open. Why is there just a tiny little patch of blood at the apartment? Again, we didn't see the apartment at the time of the attack. We don't know how much blood was there, how much blood was cleaned up. And then the investigators will make the connection of this dude watched Dexter. Dexter put down plastic all over his kill room before he murdered somebody. So was there plastic put down? Was this a scene out of Dexter? Speculation, but that could explain why there wasn't blood all over the apartment. But then again, we had days where they could clean up the apartment and they could have used bleach or hydrogen peroxide or whatever it is and gotten rid of most of the blood.
So the first plea is shot down, but the prosecutor isn't done with Christopher Scott Wilson yet and tries a second plea deal.
Well, this is after some time, and I think that the defense attorneys were seeing the writing on the wall. I don't know if they felt that strongly about their case of Chris's innocence. So they asked the prosecutor for that original deal, but instead the prosecutor offered him something else.
And this is not unheard of. You know, if you offer a deal and the defense slash the defendant doesn't take it, but then they come back to you later and say, you know what, let's just do that deal. The prosecutor now knows, hey, I've got him on the hook. I've got him just where I want them. I'll tell you what, I'll cut you a deal, but it'll be for double the time.
So it's a new deal and it's 14 years in prison. And there's a major caveat, which is he has to write a letter of confession. He has to say that he was responsible for this murder. And Chris will end up accepting this.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
He has to say that he was responsible for this murder. And Chris will end up accepting this.
Yeah, it's said that the reason he accepted the deal, it really came down to, you know, they sent the potential jurors questionnaires, and about 85% or more of the jurors said he's guilty, basically. So he didn't like his chances in court, and he thought, well, if I go down for this murder in court, I'm never going to see the light of day again. So 14 years starts to sound a lot better than life in prison, which is what he thought he would probably get if he took his chance in court.
At the plea hearing, they ask him if he caused Mackenzie Cowell's death by strangling and stabbing her. It said that he paused and said yes. He will claim that that moment, that pause, is where he wanted to say no, because he is innocent. I watched the recording of it. I actually didn't hear a pause. I thought he said yes pretty quick myself, but he claims that he is innocent, and he is doing this all under duress and under the advisement of his defense attorneys, who said, take the deal because you could get life.
Now, despite this plea deal, he maintains his innocence, and that's in phone calls and letters, that 48 hours program. He did a 5-hour interview with the Wenatchee World. In all of those, he said, I did not kill Mackenzie Cowell.
Does he say how the blood got in his apartment?
You know, if you read comments by people who believe in Chris's innocence, you know, they point out some issues with the case, and they've got some points, but I have not seen anything anywhere that adequately explains why Mackenzie's blood would have been found in his apartment. Now, one of the common things we hear is that, you know, the police must have framed him. They must have planted that blood there.
Well, how did it show up on the video when he's moving out? Like, if they planted the evidence, what'd they do? They find the Pepsi stain that was in the video and decide, oh, well, that's where we're going to plant the blood evidence. I guess that's the idea, the theory here. But when they've already established that there was a blood stain there, I'm not backward engineering what the cops might have done. I'm going to backward engineer what a murderer might have done.
Yeah, it's crazy that they try to maintain that this could have been planted, but, you know, it's on the video. I just don't understand how they can say that the video is meaningless. I mean, to me, the video shows there's a stain there, and then by the time the police get there, they don't see that stain, but it's on the video, so they pull up the carpet, and there it is. It sounds pretty definitive to me.
I don't know why there's even a question myself. I would have found this guy guilty if I was sitting on that jury. And it has nothing to do with what kind of music he listens to, what kind of tattoos he has, or anything to that effect. It would be solely based on the DNA evidence and the fact that he had positioned himself where she turned up missing on the same day at the same time. He had opportunity. What's his motive? Well, he seemed to have an interest in her. Maybe she rejected him. Maybe she rejected his advances. Maybe he just thought Dexter and murder was cool and that he wanted to fulfill some lifelong fantasy. I don't really give a crap about the motive myself. It's all about evidence.
So in the end, we definitely feel like Christopher Scott Wilson was the right person to take to court and to prosecute for this crime, even though they didn't end up prosecuting him. But still, in the end, there are some questions with this case. We already talked about the YSTR testing, and I mean, it feels like that's what they had to do in that case because it was a mixed profile and it was a low sample. The other thing here, and this is kind of what haunts me in this case, is the fact that Liz Reed, who admittedly seems crazy, came up with this ring. And there are questions about how she would know which ring to get if she did buy another ring that was similar, or if it is the ring. I mean, did the police ever recover a ring? If they can't, I mean, they can't really prove her wrong, but I mean, she did destroy her own credibility, so I guess it's easy to dismiss her. But for those of us that really want to know what happened, now we have this question of the ring in the back of our minds.
Yeah, and Liz just inserts herself into this case out of the blue. This isn't like the cops had something on her and were questioning her about the murder. So she's like, oh, well, to avoid some drug charge, I had to tell them what they wanted to hear. No, she placed herself into the case and even places herself at the crime scene and says she's seen this snuff film. I mean, this is really crazy. I get to the point where I just think she's a compulsive liar. I mean, she's not even getting 15 minutes of fame out of this. I think she just wants to feel important to somebody.
The other question in this case to me is the fact that they found blood in Wilson's apartment that he moved into after the murder. And so there was a question, could that have been Mackenzie's blood too? Could they have planted blood in that apartment thinking, oh, well, that's his apartment. We'll plant blood here to make sure we get him. Do you trust that they tested the blood and it wasn't Mackenzie Cowell's?
Well, here's the problem is we have to put our faith somewhere in the system. We have to believe that they found a DNA profile on the duct tape and it matches him. We have to believe that they found blood at his apartment, which I think that's substantiated by the video. But then we have a cigarette butt that's found at the scene with DNA on it that hasn't really been tied back to anyone. I would just assume it was tied back to his female friend. I mean, there are holes in this case, but I think the foundation of his conviction is solid. I'm more weirded out and appalled by the prosecution offering him a 6-year manslaughter deal in the beginning. And then I'm even weirded out by the fact that they're able to just change that deal on the fly. They can just do whatever they want. But 6 years? Really?
When we talked about this before, you brought up a good point, which is if they felt like they had a decent case, why didn't they just take it to court? Because if we're talking about justice for Mackenzie's family, justice would have been the murderer gets put away for life, right? Or at least a long time. A deal of less than 7 years, that's not respectful of the victim, and it's not respectful of what happened to her. So what is the point here? Maybe their case wasn't as strong as it seems. At least they didn't think so. And so they thought, or maybe they're just lazy.
That's actually what I thought at first, is they just don't want to go to trial with this. But it was actually a really big case in this town. So there would have been a lot of backlash if this guy had taken the initial plea of 6.5, 7 years.
Would there have been?
I think so.
Well, the prosecutor didn't seem to think so.
Well, hindsight's 20/20. There still has been some backlash over the 14-year sentence. People saying that's not enough for what this guy did. As much as I think this guy's guilty, it was really appalling to me that that's all the prosecutor did. The fact that they changed the plea deal makes me understand that it's somewhat arbitrary what they want to do.
Again, we've said this before, line up all the evidence on both sides. I think they've got a pretty good case, but the prosecutor himself, the way that he approached this whole thing with a plea deal and then a second plea deal, to me, it's kind of telling. There's something that is going on with the prosecutor where he has some doubt. I mean, why else give him the deal? So, and again, this isn't good for someone who may be innocent. If Christopher Scott Wilson didn't do this, then this is like a cheat to make him go to prison anyway.
Well, I've said it from the get-go. Plea deals, screw the innocent and let the guilty get off.
I mean, why not just let the evidence speak for itself? If it's not enough for the jury, then too bad. I mean, you can't possibly prosecute every single person, get all the right people in prison. It's just not going to happen, but at least you tried. You know, let the evidence speak for itself. And in this case, it didn't go down that way. So it's very disappointing. And I would imagine that if the Cowell family has problems with this case, I believe it. And I I think the prosecutor, you know, just made the wrong call, in my opinion, because if we really want justice, we need to get it right. And doing this plea deal, that didn't answer the questions. You know, I think if they had gone to court, we could have had the defense attack some of these things, attack the ring, attack the blood found in both apartments. Not that it was the same blood, supposedly, but I mean, I would like to have had answers, and having a debate between the prosecution and defense, I think would have cleared some stuff up.
Well, what's the statistic? Only 3% of cases actually go to trial and the rest are pleaded out.
So maybe this is normal.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm picking on it for all the wrong reasons. Well, actually, it might be the right reasons. Yeah. Just I'm speaking into a vacuum.
The reason why there's still questions about the case is because people were not very happy with the way law enforcement and the prosecution and judge had dealt with cases in the past. And back in 1992, there was a case that was very similar to the McMartin preschool sexual assault trials. It revolved around another family, the Everett family, Harold and Idella Everett. They had been contacted by Child Protective Services, and a bunch of them had been indicted for the molestation of children. The same defense attorney that was representing Wilson was able to get a lot of them off from these charges or exonerated of these charges. And the whole thing was a pretty big witch hunt that went on for years and years. This was a huge black eye on the law enforcement in this town. There were allegations that the police had planted evidence, had the law enforcement and CPS had really conspired against this family. And the defense attorney showed that most of it was BS and that this was a completely unfounded case. So this is why people are still questioning law enforcement. And the Everett case is very interesting. It could probably be a whole episode in on itself that we could go over.
Right. The daughters of the Everetts, by the time that this was hitting its peak, they had named 22 different homes in which they had been sexually abused.
For the prosecution to get this so wrong and the defense to understand what the system is capable of, now you can understand how somebody could make that leap in logic that law enforcement planted evidence, planted blood evidence in Chris's apartment and whatnot. But I'm not willing to make that leap myself.
No, because it's a whole different case. But when you have children saying I was sexually abused, these people touched me, you know, they were moved out of their home into other homes and they were claiming sexual abuse there or physical abuse. And it just spun out of control. I mean, when you have 43 people arrested, some of those people obviously freaked out and confessing to things they didn't do just so that the law would go easy on them. If that's in the public mind, then I could see where this is a concern and that it would spill over into another case later, I guess.
Well, and a lot of them accepted plea deals to not face extended sentences. So when you do that, you're admitting guilt. Here we have a case of that happening. It's a really sad case if you want to read into it, but you know. I think this is why people have such a distrust in law enforcement.
Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.